Good morning, friends. Today we will talk about grammatical categories. In traditional grammar, the grammatical categories are called parts of speech. Every language has at least two major grammatical categories, the noun and the verb. Two other major categories, the adjective and the adverb, may or may not be there in any given language, although they are usually they are present for some context, to some extent they are present. So most languages also have some minor grammatical categories like conjunctions, particles, adpositions, etc. As it is with most categorization schemes in descriptive grammar, these grammatical categories tend to be very diffuse at their boundaries. Sometimes there are some core notions which only lead to certain prototypes, and these prototypes can be identified, and based on these prototypes the different words are classified into these grammatical categories. So what are these? So they are now known as word classes as well in the modern terminology. Before we go into what these types are, there is another interesting property of grammatical categories that is of very big importance, which tries to give the membership of any given word to the category intended. Now, such variation in the category membership may or may not be directly reflected in the surface, morphology, or syntactic forms, but it is always inherent. Sometimes more subtle morphosyntactic tests are needed to determine the formal category of a particular word or a lexeme. And at other times, the category membership can be given a form that can only be inferred from the context of the discourse. Such grammatical categories are very distinct from formal relational categories such as subject, object, predicate, or the functional categories such as agent, patient, topic, definitive, noun phrase, etc. These grammatical categories form the elements. They are the building blocks of linguistic structure. Sometimes they are also called lexical categories because many of these forms can be specified for their grammatical category in their mental lexicon. However, we do not use the term lexical category because, number one, the term grammatical category is more widely understood, and number two, the category of a word depends as much on how the word is used as on the conventional lexical meaning. So the two reasons why we are not using it, using the term lexical category, is what I just spoke about right now. Now, it is therefore important to understand what these, what the formal characteristics are that tend to distinguish between these categories or word classes. The first one is the noun. For the major grammatical categories, the noun and the verb, the prototypes can be identified with meaning, that is, semantically. The class of nouns in any language includes words that express the most stable of concepts, that is, stable in the sense of temporality, or what is known as time stable. It's a hyphenated word, time hyphen stable. So this time stable concepts, like, for example, mountain, house, rock, tree, these are semantically arranged. These are concepts that characteristically do not vary much over the time. Prototypical nouns, therefore, are words that express highly and obviously time-stable concepts. A concept like fist or hand does not characteristically persist over a long period of time. Therefore, one would not want to use the morphosyntactic properties of the word fist to define nouns in general. Some languages may not express this concept with a single noun either. For example, German is known to combine different nouns to form a larger compound noun in trying to describe these types of forms. In determining whether any given word is a noun or not, one must first determine the morphosyntactic characteristics of prototypical nouns. So what are these? The morphosyntactic properties of nouns fall into two groups, distributional or configurational, and structural properties. The distributional properties have to do with how words are distributed in phrases, clauses, and texts. For example, nouns can serve as heads of noun phrases, subjects or objects of clauses, and topics of sentences. The structural properties have to do with the internal structure of the noun itself. For example, in some languages, nouns exhibit case marking, number marking, gender marking, etc. Or, say for example, you have person marking as well sometimes in some languages, whereas other grammatical categories do not tend to exhibit these properties. Now, I referred to the word head of a noun phrase a little earlier. So, what is this head of a noun? It is one word within the phrase that refers to same entity as the whole phrase itself. For example, if you say the desktop computer, it is the computer that you refer to as the times table concept. And the desktop is used only as an adjectival format. So we suspect that this phrase, the desktop computer, is a noun phrase. And the head noun of this, the main noun, or which we write as N subscript 0, is something which is a times table concept of the computer. So the question arises as to how you're going to make these decisions. The answer is easy. The whole phrase refers to a particular object, which is basically the computer, and therefore it is taken to be the head of the noun phrases, of this particular noun phrase. For languages that have no grammatical category of adjective, or for where adjectives and nouns are very similar formally, the identification of the head of the noun phrase can be more subtle and more difficult. In such languages, there could be an equal reference to the entity. And so we are not going to go into that kind of a complication, because English allows you to have these differentiation. So this noun phrase is a thing that persists in the discourse. Almost every language that has grammaticalized these ways of adjusting these grammatical categories or subcategories, it refers to as some kind of a derivational process. For example, some forms function grammatically as nouns but derive from roots that are semantically more closer to the verbs. For such forms, the time stability criterion is difficult to apply, if not impossible. Therefore, only criteria available for the distributional and structural properties of the form, like you have in traditional grammar, like noun is the name of a person, place or thing, etc. Now, coming to English, English is a word, English words that are there suffixed with ing. ing is a morpheme, which illustrate how to determine the categorical status of derived forms. Think of the word walking. It is difficult to think of this word as expressing a time-stable concept, but the concept inherently involves motion and change, and additionally is not a prototypical noun, but from the distributional and structural properties of this form is to determine it is like a noun. Prototypical nouns can function like subjects and objects of clauses. Walking is good for you. I like walking, etc., etc. Now, the structural properties of prototypical nouns include, number one, the possibility of taking descriptive modifiers like the red book, in which the red can be used as an adjective of the head word book, which is the N0. And number two, the use of genitive cases for pronouns like my book. My is a genitive case. Again, the form walking passes both of these tests. You can say as a descriptive modifier, slow walking. And in case of a genitive case, his walking was fast. So it passes both tests. But even though the word walking passes both the major tests of nounhood, there are other tests that reveal that it is not the best example of a noun. For example, the ability to pluralize, to take determiners, to take a wide range of descriptive modifiers are all properties of prototypical nouns in English. So the prototype noun is an important consideration because these pluralization, determiners, and descriptive modifiers cannot be applied to a noun like walking. So do we use the word walking as a noun? Well, yes, we should. The verb suffix with ing can sometimes also be used as adverbial modifiers. Now, there's this morphosyntactic property that makes walking seem a little more like a verb. It shows motion, but although at the same time it can be used as a noun. So there are some solutions that can be propagated and proposed for this particular kind of a situation. Number one is that taking some nominal properties, noun properties, as the criterion for nouns. We could simply say that a noun for English is a form that can refer to only argument within a genitive pronoun. Secondly, we can also say that making up of a different grammatical category for each complex of nominal features that are started by some form or forms of the language. And thirdly, we can acknowledge that the difference between nouns and verbs is a continuum, and that verbs like ing suffix fall somewhere in between the two extremes. The first solution is problematic because A, it cannot be applied universally, and B, it ignores the obvious but inexact semantic basis for the grammatical category. Solution 2 is the approach traditionally taken in descriptive grammar and has the advantage of giving the grammarian some leverage as to how to place the word types and word classes in the language. But the basic problem with this approach is like the first solution, it is not universally applicable. The category is derived from the various word clusters of morphosyntactic properties are A, not necessarily related to one another in any specific or systematic way, and B, not comparable from one language to the other. This situation makes the grammatical description a less reliable format to accept. However, we have the third solution, which reflects most accurately the nature of the linguistic categorization, that there is... So what is the third solution? Let me repeat that again. It is that the difference between nouns and verbs exists as a continuum, and that verbs with ing suffixes fall somewhere in between these two extremes. So on one side you have the noun, on the other you have the verb, and then the solution of how to categorize a word, just you need to just put it somewhere in between. So what happens in the case of 3, the third solution? Let us look at some of the disadvantages of using this particular solution first. Number one, that there is no explicit way of determining exactly where on the continuum between verb and noun it can be placed, the category can be placed. But this approach assumes that all properties are weighted equally in terms of their effect on the category membership. So this usually is regarded as a problem of the third approach as well, because it is, in this case, it is futile to rank the morphosyntactic properties according to their importance. Secondly, it is often the case that we do not know what all are the relevant properties that are there to our given form. Sometimes we are faced with potentially thousands of forms which each exhibiting a cluster to form to cluster from 0 to 10 nominal properties that can be attached. And thirdly, the point of a grammatical sketch is to help the users understand how particular constructions function within the grammatical system of the language. Now, given the observations that such a task would also potentially be of unlimited complexity, it is not likely that many grammarians and linguists would attempt such a ranking in the first place. So the recommended approach is to combine solutions 2 and 3 into something like the following. Forms that are indeterminate as to their grammatical category membership, such as verbs with ing, can be given strictly formal labels like ing participles, with an explanation given on their characteristic functions and key morphosyntactic properties. In most cases, the term participle is used, which is a relatively widely understood term for verb forms that have reduced verbal properties, but which are not full nominalizations yet. The full nominalization or full conversion to a full noun happens to a little less degree. Clauses formed with participle verbs are often referred to as participle phrases, and this participle becomes a form which is a reduced form of the verb itself. Languages normally, however, have more than one such form, and as mentioned previously in this lecture, the term participle has no more specific universal definition. So, with this brief introduction, let us go into the types of nouns that are possible. So, now every language has certain grammatically defined subclasses of nouns. Many languages also have a noun class system that consists of many finer distinctions. If the language has a noun class system, it should be described separately. But for now, let us look at what are the major categories of nouns themselves. Number one is proper nouns. Number two, common nouns. Then there is another where possessibility is a distinctive characteristic. So you have within the possessibility framework, type 1, type 2, and type 3 distinctions. Type 1 refers to possessable versus unpossessable forms. Type 2 refers to inherently possessed versus optionally possessed nouns. And type 3 refers to alienably possessed versus inalienably possessed nouns. Now, Let us examine each of them in a little more detail. In an African language belonging to the Eastern Nilotic family, which is Maasai, we have the type 1 system, where non-possessible and possessable forms are distinctive. You can say my land and you can say my child, but they are two distinguishable forms. There is another language in South Sulawesi which is called Seko Padang, where optionally possessed versus obligatorily possessed forms are possible. Like you can say my shirt, also shirt. You can say my basket, but you cannot say just basket. So this distinction exists. Finally, in many other languages, there are two grammatically distinct possession strategies. All nouns can be possessed. They can be alienable versus inalienable possessions. The first one, that is the rather the second one, so the inalienable possession is used for roughly the same class of nouns that are possessible in type 1 languages like Maasai that I referred to earlier. And inherently possessed languages in type 2 like Seko Padang. Alienable, inalienable and inherent possessions are therefore described to be the more formal forms of most languages. And combinations of these types develop the noun system of any language. Then there is count versus mass nouns, countable nouns versus uncountable nouns. Like sand is a mass noun. You cannot say many sands. You have to say much sand or some sand. You cannot say a sand. Whereas you can say about the count nouns, countable nouns, cars, many cars, but you cannot say much car. Or some car, as opposed to some sand. But you can say a car. So you have this distinction between mass noun and countable noun. Now notice that this distinction is based on semantics, but is also the evidence for existence of more formal properties of this particular distinction. So what is the structure of the noun word? The structure is something like you have a stem, and then to this stem you have to attach all the forms like possessive. That is, a noun word consists of an optional possessive prefix, an obligatory stem, an optional diminutive or an augmentative suffix, an optional classifier either before or after, and an optional plural suffix. This format is true for all nouns of all systems. Now there is some problem when we talk about pronouns or what are known as anaphoric clitics. For many languages, it is difficult to distinguish pronouns from the agreement patterns of affixes. Here, we should usually follow very strict formal definitions because it must be kept in mind that there is no direct correlation between function of a particular device in one language and formally similar devices in other languages, although there are generalities that can be made. Pronouns are free forms as opposed to affixes that function alone to fulfill the position of a noun phrase in a clause. So it just replaces or it could potentially replace a noun phrase. They normally have all the distributional properties of noun phrases. Whereas the anaphoric clitic is not free morphologically. They must, I say, must attach to another word. That is, the process of attaching to another word is called cliticization. CLITICIZATION. And the words that use this process is called a clitic, CLITIC. However, like pronouns, they are in complementary distribution with full noun phrases. That is, typically either a noun phrase or a clitic, but not both, can refer to an entity in a given clause. Now, there are some noun systems which are very important for us to understand. Most of this will be discussed in much more detail in a subsequent lecture, but as an introduction, it is sufficient to understand that person, number, and gender are three formal categories that or properties that can be attached to a noun. So what is person? The first, second, and third persons are the traditional grammatical definitions or terms that are used. So what is the first person? The first person refers to the speaker. The second person refers to the hearer. So the first and second person frameworks, referents, are sometimes collectively referred to as speech act participants. And the third person usually refers to any non-speech act participant. So you have the first person, singular, plural, the second person, singular, plural, and the third person, singular, plural. So the plural forms form the number system. Like nouns, pronouns and anaphoric clitics are also variable with number. The most common number distinctions are singular versus plural. However, there are some languages like Samoan, for example, or Sanskrit, which have singular, dual, plural. And then you have another distinction, which is in terms of gender noun class. The typical gender categories include masculine, feminine, and neuter gender or inanimate gender. Recently, however, because of the growth of the activism on the language and accessibility forms and language equivalence for or language equality for all classes of gender stereotypes that exclude the gender stereotypes and include other forms, we have sometimes a third gender form that is attached. Like you previously had he, she, and it. So we include this fourth gender called ji, xe. In many formal documents in the European Union, this change has been brought about. Secondly, so you have her and jer, xer. So this kind of extension has been made to accommodate the third gender or people with what you can say the identifiable non traditional gender forms that they identify with, but they are not part of the entire framework of language. So language can be a little bit tricky in this sense. Many languages now provide much richer system by classifying these nouns into a system of grammatical relations and semantic roles. Then you have definiteness or specificity, definite versus indefinite nouns, like say whoever, whatever, whenever, wherever, they are non-specific nouns. A third person plural form is often used to refer to non-specific or indefinite forms. Then you have honorifics. So you can say, for example, like in Hindi, you can have three different degrees of honorification. Like you can say tu, you can say tum, you can say aap. But in English, all of them are covered by the pronoun you. So in many languages, except English, other than English, these honorifics can vary on an everyday basis. For example, it is also used in standard Spanish. Sometimes using tú and te for the second person, subject and object pronouns, when speaking to a familiar manner, person with a familiar tone. A more formal situation would use usted and te are more appropriate, or usted and le. So we can see that there are some terms or some questions that come to the forefront while discussing nouns as a category. What are these? Number one, what are the distributional properties of nouns? Number two, what are the structural properties of nouns? Number three, what are the formal major categories or subcategories of nouns that are distinctively possible? What are the basic structures of the noun word? Example from polysynthetic languages. Does the language have free pronouns or anaphoric clitics or both? So these questions basically help us in trying to categorize the nouns. Now, the second part of this lecture is dedicated to verbs. The class of verbs in any language is the grammatical category that includes lexemes that express the least time stable of concepts, that is, events such as run, break, die, swim, etc. As you have seen with nouns, the time stability continuum only defines the prototypes. In determining whether a questionable form is a verb or not, or of word when you are trying to put it in one cluster or the other, like whether it's a noun or a verb, one must determine how closely it follows the morphosyntactic patterns of prototypical verbs. So what are these morphosyntactic properties of prototypical verbs? They fall into two groups. One is distributional or configurational, and the other one is structural. Distributional properties have to do with how words function in phrases, clauses, and texts. For example, verbs can serve as heads of verb phrases, predicates of clauses, and they code events inside of a text. Structural properties, on the other hand, have to do with the internal structure of the verb itself. For example, in some languages, verbs exhibit subject-verb agreement, tense aspect, modality marking, etc., whereas forms that belong to other grammatical categories do not. There is another major aspect which comes to the forefront when dealing with verbs, that of semantic roles. So, because before discussing these various types of verbs that may exist in language, it is necessary to understand this notion of what a semantic role is. So let us first define this. So, semantic roles are conceptual relationships that influence the morphosyntax in a very profound manner, and they are not primarily They are not primarily morphosyntactic categories per se. They are part of the content of linguistic message rather than the categories of linguistic form. So it's basically what role it plays in the grammatical scheme, in the structure. For example, if in some situation somebody called John speaks to somebody named Bill, then John is the agent and Bill is the patient of the speaking event, regardless of whether any observer ever utters a phrase or a clause like John speaks to Bill to describe that particular event. So it is something that happens even when somebody has not spoken about that event. So it is more of a semantic notion that of a particular event that is happening. Often there's a term that is used for referring to these participants of a particular speech act and their semantic roles that are normally associated with a given verb. This is called an argument. For example, a scene typically describes, say, for example, the verb eat in English. You have an eater and a thing that is eaten. Therefore, the verb eat is said to have two arguments, that is, conceptually or semantically or formally. So here we have the arguments of a verb and their semantic roles that must be specified in the lexical or dictionary entry for each verb. Sometimes this information is known as the argument structure or case frame of the verb. And this led to people like Fillmore or Anderson develop more formal frameworks of what is called the case grammar. In the tradition of case grammar, semantic roles are referred to as cases or deep cases. In the traditional or generative grammar format, they have come to be called thematic roles or simply theta roles. So the terminology thematic structure or thematic role is a conflict that happens. So we will stick to talking about theta roles that would be more appropriate, or semantic role to be more unambiguous. So what are these common thematic roles or semantic roles? You have those of agent, force, instrument, experiencer, recipient, and patient. Some others are there, that of location, direction, setting, purpose, time, and manner. And these are taken together to form the basis of the structural notions of the common thematic roles or common semantic roles or common theta roles. In the next lecture, we will look at how these different frameworks generate our understanding of the system of these word classes.